Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
So yes, a new year, a new QuakeCast. RC is, not gone forever, but JCR is always stepping in and helping out, and love to have you on this new episode. So who do we have today as our special guest?
We have a man by the name of Shifty. He is a guy behind an interesting new project that is bridging the gap between the classic Quake that we all know and love and modern indie games.
It's called Quido, and it takes what we love about Quake mapping and takes Trench Broom and all the power and features of that, and then bridges that with the Godot game engine. So hey, Shifty will get into that in just a second. But without further ado, let's hear how Shifty got into Quake.
So I go a long way back with Quake. I started on the N64. Thanks to a friend of mine called Mark, who had some rather permissive parents, thanks to him having older brothers. I used to go around his house on weekends and we'd play, you know, all the classics like GoldenEye, Perfect Dark, and Quake 1 and 2. So, like, obviously it doesn't quite hold a candle to the PC version, but it got me in there early. Like, experiencing all of the, well, yeah, just all of the stuff that defines Quake, and it's kind of stuck with me for a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who have a affinity for the N64 version of Quake because of the music and some of the different, different maps. And that first kind of GoldenEye type of joy of multiplayer, having another option.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for me, it's been a long time since I touched the N64 version. Like, I remember reading quite recently that there are different maps and such, like, and, like, that's the thing, because it was my friend's copy. He was the one who had, like, all of the knowledge on it. Like, oh, whoa, you can, you know, find the secret and go through, you know, a slipgate to, like, Ziggurat Vertigo. Whoa, man. You know, so, yeah, I would call myself more familiar with, like, the PC one these days. But, certainly in terms of, like, the multiplayer was a big thing. Like, getting a bunch of friends together around the N64, like, in the playroom back in the day, and just having, like, a four-way frag fest. That was good stuff.
Yeah, there's something special about split screen that just people have really fond memories of it. I've never been a huge fan of split screen, but I know people love it. It's just kind of because I'm old.
It was a simpler time. Yeah. The split screen days were simpler times.
Of course, yeah.
Filthy screen lookers, how dare you?
Yeah, don't look at where I am. Oh, you found the quad. Nice, I'm out of here. That's great. Yeah, I think... definitely GoldenEye is something I need to change that up and get some.
I'm feeling the same myself. I was just like poking around online the other day, like, what's the definitive way to play GoldenEye these days? You know, there's like UE4 remakes of it and what have you. But I'm thinking like, well, since the XBLL.
Like, not to go too far off topic, but there is a way to play GoldenEye now with mouse and keyboard.
Oh, I've heard about that. Yeah,
they have like hacks and stuff so that you can get it up to like 60 FPS or more.
Sounds
in a way,
wild.
It makes the game a little easy because it wasn't designed for that. But it's a very pleasant way to play now, especially for some of us who haven't played it.
No, I'll get after it.
Yeah, I mean, I need
so
to
now
do the same.
So now you went from Quake and on an N64 to a little bit later, you started into kind of dabbling in development.
Yeah, like that, again, development was something that struck me from a fairly early age, like because I got a copy of the Games Factory, which is an old Click Team thing that's like a sort of like WYSIWYG game making tool, if you like. It's got very simple, you know, like sprite editing, animation editing, and logic stuff that you can use to craft games in. And so that's where I started out in, like, my secondary school years. And it was just like, I want to learn how this stuff works. I want to, you know, make my own stuff. I remember I was so into it that I actually tried to convince the school's IT team to let me host sort of impromptu game dev session. You know, like the little casual mini course thing, you know, for the other students. But that unfortunately fell through, and I doubt that loading IO Quake 3 onto the school network for cheeky LAN parties was helpful to my case there, but there you go.
Oops. That's funny. That's cool. So you're trying to get, even when you were younger, trying to get a game jam going. That's really laudable. So now, would it be fair to say that's how you got your start in programming, or had you been coding before that?
So no, like, it was all in on this sort of like WYSIWYG, you know, like UI based creation up until I hit university and went into a games technology course, which is where I got onto things like C#, C++, and was introduced to UDK, like the Unreal Development Kit, that sort of half step between UE3 and UE4 that Epic put out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that taught me a few things about, you know, like how much more complex it is to deal with a 3D 3D engine, 3D worlds, that kind of thing. And led me to, like, in my own time, do a hell of a lot of research and experimentation into things like, at one point, like, I wrote a ray tracer, like, all sorts of stuff. And then eventually moving into Unity, which became my first, like, proper game engine, I suppose. So, yeah, from Unity, like, I diddled around in that for a while, you know, went through my game development course, which didn't really cover, like, the general purpose engines very much. It was more, like, working with programming languages and, like, the XNA framework, which is, that was an early sort of Xbox Live thing, I believe, used for their sort of community-created and submitted content. And so that was all right, a bit limited. So I sort of struck out on, you know, my own terms to do stuff in my own time, and have largely, my main thing has always been proving gameplay concepts. Like, I am notoriously bad at putting projects out, which is something I'm trying to turn around with Godot. But it's always been a case of, like, okay, cool, can I make a belt scroller beat 'em up, like Streets of Rage, and make that work, add some combos, you know, like air juggles, experiment with mechanics. But when it comes to actually taking that mechanical core that's, like, ready to rock and building it out into a bigger game, it tends to taper off. Like, and I think that partly ties into the creation of, well, largely assets. So enemies and such, like player, like graphics and things, so I'm not just using placeholders, but also levels, which ties into, like, the Cadeau and Trench Broom side of things, because it's always been something I've considered myself kind of clueless with regard to, is level design. But that's something that I think stems from lack of proper tools. Like, I've fiddled around in Doom Builder, Slade, and those sorts of things during, like, a period in my teens when I was big into Doom. Like, I actually fiddled around and put out a few small WODs, like gameplay and weapon things, and even one map that I was reasonably proud of at the time, but has since been lost to the internet.
Would you... okay. I was going to say, you wouldn't want to drop the names of those for the audience and for some of us to check out?
Well, one of them I know is still floating around that can be found is called Demonizer for Doom 1, which is a gameplay mod that basically gives you, like, a devil form that you can transform into after collecting a certain amount of souls, which are a new, like, pickup dropped from enemies, and it's just a way to sort of, like, mix things up and change gameplay for a little while and, like, give the player a sort of controllable power-up, if you like. So I think that's probably still floating around the Zed Doom forums, but unfortunately the map, which I think was probably my better work, I've forgotten the name of. It's like overwritten itself in my head as like the Unholy Cathedral, but that's the name of a classic Doom map. Like, that's straight up not not the thing. So it's probably out there somewhere, but unfortunately it was lost to me in one of many unfortunate hard drive accidents over the years.
And you wouldn't be the first.
Yeah, that is something I have learned. Like, you learn the lesson after a while, though, right? Just, like, set up some sort of solution and don't worry about it anymore.
So, yeah, I guess this is a perfect segue into the first reminder of the year for everyone who's creating cool stuff to back it up regularly. Back up your stuff.
Yeah. This is a public service announcement with guitars. So cool. So now, let's get into Godot then, because, you know, some of the members of our audience may not know what the heck we're talking about. And so I think probably starting out with Godot, explaining a little bit about Godot and then what Godot allows you to do.
Yeah, so Godot is a game engine. It's similar to Unreal 4 or Unity in that it is a general purpose game engine available to the public for free. It's completely open source, and it's considered something of an up-and-comer. Like, its name is somewhat accurate in being named after Waiting for Godot, because it's been one of these things where, like, this game engine has such potential and will be amazing at some time in the future, and it's gradually getting there and is now at the point where it's like, yeah, this is actually pretty good, to the point where, you know, I've jumped in and given it a go and found it to be very sort of freeing and open in its design. Like, I like to build tools, much like Godot, which we will get to, which is something that all the engines allow you to do, like Unity, Unreal, etc. They all have some degree or other of letting you customize the editing process to work for you. But Godot has been unique in that it doesn't it's very, again, sort of like open. It puts a minimal amount of obstacles in your way and things to trip you up in your journey to build the thing that works the way you want it to. Or at least that's been my experience in the, about, I would say, a month of using it.
I'm sorry, you've only been using Godot for a month?
Yeah, so...
Wow. And you're already doing like this insane plugin. That's crazy.
Well, that's the thing. After a while as a programmer, when you've used enough programming languages and engines, it all kind of begins to flow together. Like, the overall concepts and sort of practices around either programming or game development are all sort of like they're a shared umbrella over the engines, and the engines implement sort of like related sort of helper systems in their own ways, which is the part you really have to get to grips with. But when it comes to like, I have this overarching idea, this big idea, and I want to make it happen, like, generally speaking, it's not too big of a deal to just like dive in and be like, cool, where are the tools? Like, grab this from over here, cool, yep, this lines up with my existing knowledge of these systems and that kind of thing, and just sort of figure it out, as it were.
Nice. That's great. So now Godot, so that was born out of, kind of, put it this way, it's a mesh-based renderer, right? So you really need to have, to create assets, you really have to know Blender or Maya or what have you to make the meshes. Is that kind of where Godot kind of came from? Is that the problem you're trying to solve?
Pretty much, yes. Like, asset creation has always been something that I have considered myself kind of clueless at, which isn't necessarily the best mindset to have, because that's a little defeatist. It's like, oh, well, I'll never be good at that. But I think about it in terms of playing to one's strengths. Like, I've always been big on the programming side of things, and when presented with, like, okay, cool, it's time for you to learn Blender so you can, you know, crank out some bad 3D models to use for your game, or, like, some, you know, environments while not really knowing what you're doing. Because these tools are huge. They have so much functionality, and, like, they can do so many things. And it's very intimidating to, you know, like, open it up and fiddle around a bit and just be like, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. Oh my god, I'm going to have to sink so many hours into learning how to do these most basic things, and then just sort of like live in blissful ignorance of the rest of the tool set. Which, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that. I like to know my tools inside and out if possible. So it's like, okay, can I find a tool that I can consider, like, I can learn to a degree of proficiency that is intuitive enough that I could, like, dive in, learn it to the degree that I'm happy with, and start making levels, you know, like building environments in a way that I've never been able to before. And so that is where sort of the genesis of Godot came from. Was I was actually playing Arcane Dimensions. Like, it's I heard about it, I think, a year or so ago in a forum thread somewhere, and was like, whoa, that sounds amazing. Classic Quake with, you know, like, new maps and all sorts of extra functionality, enemies, and by all accounts, it sounds like the actual quality of the mapping and such is amazing. I should get on this. And then I promptly forgot for about another 6 months or so. But fast forward to recently, I was playing it. I finally got around to, you know, getting my hands on it and playing through some of Arcane Dimensions. And I drifted onto the Trench Broom trailer somehow or other. I can't quite remember how, but I found myself watching, like, the rather impressive Trench Broom 2.0 sort of introductory trailer, where it shows you all of the sort of like big ticket features that make it really easy to edit levels, like multi-brush clipping or texture alignment across multiple faces and that sort of thing, and just being able to like drag Geo out of nowhere, create brushes and mess with vertices and things. And so that was kind of a revelation, because it's like I mentioned previously that I've fiddled with, you know, Slade and Doom Builder in the past, which are very simple, you know, 2.5D kind of affairs. But for 3D, like, the seeing a modern Quake editor was kind of the linchpin that sort of put everything into place of like, oh yeah, you can have an approachable editor that is usable by, like, you know, anyone who's willing to put in a little bit of time and is, you know, familiar with Quake level concepts of, you know, like three-dimensional environments and placing of entities, you know, enemies, power-ups and what have you. And so I saw that and was just like, I need this in my life now. And I started programming. And that's where it all began.
That's great. That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, and also there's a lot of benefits to it. It's not like you have to replace the tool set or anything. You're just adding another tool to the Godot, you know, workflow. And think about it, you can iterate so quickly without having to launch Blender and do, like you said, all the crazy, like,
exactly,
book learning on Blender. But, and also another aspect to this is joy and fun, you know, because, and I know JCR agrees with me, or will probably agree with me, that it's just fun to use Trench Brew. And it's a chore to use some of the other editors, but, and you kind of fight them and you're kind of struggling, but Trench Brew is just so effortless. And once you spend a day or two, you know, making, pulling brushes in and out and moving things, it's just, it's fun.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, even something so simple as clipping out like the basic arch I have in the Kudo test map feels like unimaginable power at my fingertips when using Trench Brew. It's just like, I want to use this tool more. Like, a consistent feeling I've had throughout the process of developing Kudo is, when am I going to get around to making some maps? I'm so busy programming this thing so I can use maps, but I'm not getting time to make any.
We all agree Trench Boom is a very powerful tool. So it's just another way to leverage this tool in a way that probably its creator wasn't anticipating.
Yeah, certainly. Like, I've seen a little bit of surprise from hanging out in the Trench Broom Discord and just like talking about Godot and actually having a natter with Christian Dusk on, you know, just like about, you know, like, why did you make it? What's the idea? Like, oh, cool. Wow.
Yeah. You're being modest there. I think he was pretty impressed. I know him fairly well, I guess, just from interacting online, and he seemed very impressed, which is very hard to do, by the way.
Oh, that's good to hear. It's like, it's sometimes hard to get a read on people through text, you know, like, I know myself, I have like a slightly clipped and serious like way about me through text, or at least I can do. And so it can be a bit hard to be like, all right, yeah, there's actually like, enthusiasm, cool. But yeah, like going back to what you were saying about, you know, like Trench Broom being the, you know, it's like intuitive and a joy to use and having to wrestle old editors, like I have to agree there as well, because when I got into this whole thing and was like, okay, so how does the Quake map format work? You know, like, what tools do you use? Like, I'm most familiar with Quake 3, I suppose, since it's what I've played most recently. But how does that work? So I grabbed a copy of GTK Radiant and was just like, oh God, how do I do this? It was like the almost like diving into Blender, although I might just be a case of me bouncing off because, you know, no easy WASD controls and mouse panning.
Yeah, I remember having just a lot of stomach issues when I was working on GTK Radiant. you know, and it's just funny how a UI can change your whole experience. And people, at the time, it was a good decision to use GTK, I guess. But boy, it was painful. But anyway,
I mean, I've heard it's incredibly powerful. But yeah, it is just that initial sort of shock factor of like, this is completely alien to me in terms of like 3D spaces and the navigation thereof. Like,
I think it's safe to say it's has a steeper barrier to entry than Trench Broom would.
All the Radiant variants are very elegant in certain ways. So in other words, brush building, I use that word a lot, elegant. It's just like, once you get used to it, and I don't know if anybody watches Sock's stuff, but you just look at Sock pulling out, you know, he uses a variant of Radiant. And so there are things that are really strong in the UI that Carmack actually created. He created that for QuakeEd. And so there are some good things, but I think what happens is, it's, you know, the community comes in and starts to pile on all this functionality and all these things that are kind of wedged in, and it's open source. So you kind of, you know, things just gets crammed in there. And Trench Broom has been very well protected by Christian. I believe, you know, there have been collaborators, but Eric W. and Christian are uber, you know, programmers, and Christian definitely keeps it on rails. Like, he does not let a whole lot of divergence happen. So it is it really is kind of shaping into a really good general purpose tool for many, you know, applications.
Yeah, and there is certainly something to be said for having like strong project leadership that's got like a vision that's like, okay, I can't let this necessarily be, you know, like shaken around by things that people are demanding right now. It's like you have to take it into account that stuff to a degree, just because, you know, people are going to be using your tool and you want your tool to be, you know, very usable. But at the same time, it's like, well, no, hang on. We have to take the proper tack on this and integrate it properly to make sure that the project remains maintainable, remains, you know, like consistent in terms of the user interface and various other elements. It's, yeah, it's something that's really good to have, I think.
So now to walk me through, just as a neophyte, because let me back up a little bit. I started looking at Godot as soon as Godot came out, before I reached out to you. I was just curious, like, hey, how does this work? What does it do? You know, because I don't know Blender at all, and I don't do any 3D modeling or anything at this point. And so I was just really curious. And then Godot seems really great. I mean, there are drawbacks and there's kind of give and take there. But let's just put it this way. What are you working on and how does it help you?
The thing that actually spawned Godot from this whole thing is a project I'm working on mysteriously called HS2, which I guess I'll demystify that now. It stands for Hypershooting 2. It's an iteration on a very old project I made in Unity that was like, what if we took the ARS suit from Vanquish and made a first-person game trying to take the sort of like mechanics of having a crazy super suit and codify them in first-person shooter form with your sort of like classic shooter basis. And so I got to the point with HS2 of, you know, having a character that can move around a space with a gun that can shoot things, with some sort of like tribes style skating mechanics and action Half-Life-esque dives and all sorts of things like that. And it occurred to me, like, I need to be able to make good spaces for this. So I started poking around for, you know, inspiration and ran across the Trench Broom trailer via Arcane Dimensions, built the thing, and the idea is that it lets me build something in Trench Broom and then tab out and go to the Godot editor and just click one button, and then the map geometry is in. It's in the Godot editor and it has collision and it can be used in the context of a game that is made in Godot.
Wow, that's cool. That is very cool.
Very nice.
Thanks. It's I wanted to make it as sort of like seamless as possible, because you can export you know, like standard interchange formats from map editors like Trench Broom and then import them into, you know, like 3D modeling packages for export as, you know, game engine friendly formats, or in some cases bring them directly into the engines themselves. And that does have a few benefits, you know, because then you've got things like, well, I suppose exporting directly from an editor will give you the same geometry as you see in the editor, you know, like un-QBSP'd maps. So just lots of brushes intersecting, all of that sort of thing. And you can bring, there are ways and means to bring QBSP maps into game engines without involving, you know, like a specialized plugin like Godot. But my main concern was like, okay, well, what if I wanted to leverage the Quake map format to be able to build static level geometry and populate it with entities as you would for Quake? Without having to, you know, like fiddle around and split the workflow between Godot and Trench Broom or something along these lines. And so that's sort of the main idea behind it, is being able to tab between the windows quickly and just regenerate the map, and the changes are there and your level is populated. So you can do stuff on top of that in Godot. Things like, you know, a lighting pass, because Godot will render lights in real time, unlike most Quake editors. And of course, you know, the lighting pipeline is very different, so it tends to be better to do lighting in engine, that sort of thing.
Now, actually, on that note, I did want to ask if Godot has support for like all the various point and brush entities that are native to Quake.
So the line I've been walking is that I want to support the map format in general. So the concept of having entities, having brushes, having entities that contain brushes and have like a class name that assigns them some unique functionality in the engine. But I don't necessarily want to go all in on replicating Quake. and bringing across all of its, you know, like limitations and specificities. Stuff like the target name and target system, for instance, you know, that's very specific to Quake and is very accessible for Quake and supported by, you know, Trench Broom with entity connection visualization and that sort of thing. But I've been thinking, I've been considering that sort of level of stuff as like that's something that you can build on top of Godot as like a game specific module if you did want to say make a Quake source port in Godot, you know, if you're mad enough to do that, or at least just try and reproduce Quake accurately in terms of how it handles its entities, like implementing things like funk train, the various right. like specific things that you would probably design differently in a modern engine just depending on your personal workflow or how you're structuring your game.
So how would you handle something like a door? So you would build the geometry and then you would take, so in other words, is it an entire mesh or can you break it into little piece components?
So the way the map file stores that is like saying that in Trench Broom, you were to create like a brush and say, okay, this is a funk door, save it. It would then write it into the map file as its own single entity with, you know, whatever brushes that you've given it. And so then it's got, you know, the various properties in Trench Broom that define, you know, like which direction it moves and that sort of thing. And so what you could do in Godot is write an extension on top of Godot. It uses something called build steps. Like they're arranged into a build pipeline, which is, you know, like build visuals, build collision, build lighting, build triggers, that sort of thing. So you could set up one of those saying, okay, I want you to take all things tagged with the funk door class name and sub in this Godot specific object that acts like a door and takes those parameters and behaves appropriately that I have created in Godot specifically for this purpose. So the idea being that you can build your own game-specific implementation on top of it, even introducing things like new entity definitions or even face definitions to the Quake map format via FGD files and like game configs for Trench Broom, and then using the map format's sort of, you know, like property, entity, brush interchange, turn those into actual usable game entities in Godot without having to do anything extra other than build that entity itself in code.
Nice. So is that something you're planning for your H2 project?
So, the idea has generally been like, okay, what will I need for HS2? And also, like, well, that's the thing. It initially began as just a simple way to get static geo in from Trench Broom to Godot for the sake of building stuff for HS2. You know, very sort of simple use case, open source it, see where it goes. And it has very rapidly sort of bloomed into this thing of like, well, I might as well support as much of the like classic Quake stuff as I can that makes sense to do so in like a generalized tool like this. Because there's a lot of people in the Quake community who are interested in sort of amateur game development, it would seem, and have the skills to create, you know, these amazing maps that would be incredibly well used both, you know, in Quake or in their own original work.
Yeah, I mean, I all I can say is ever since I took a look at Godot and what you've created, Quidot, it has my gears turning because I don't have these dreams of making games. This is all for, you know, because I have a career and et cetera, but it's all for personal development and learning and just pushing yourself. And I can tell you right now, I do have plans in the new year to do something aside from Quake. I'm not leaving the Quake community, but once I finish that, I'm definitely going to load up Godot and start fiddling around with this because Godot would be a next step after this interim step that I'm planning with my personal development. So it's really cool. It's got me extremely excited. And again, it turned me on to Godot in the first place. I'd heard of it, but I didn't know, you know, all the pluses. I love how everything's integrated in one application. That is one of the coolest things. And it's clean and smartly designed. So very cool stuff.
And we know that because of our experience with Trench Broom, we know that a nice user experience really lends itself to bringing in a wider audience of people who maybe they wouldn't sit there and figure out everything about Radiant, but they'll dabble with Trench Broom and, you know, reach the same ends to some extent.
Yeah, and hopefully...
I don't know if I'm thinking about that the right way.
No, I think you're onto something there. Like, the there is a set of users who would be interested in using, you know, classical tools to build their stuff, but would bounce off of something as complex and powerful as Radiant in comparison to something like Trench Broom, where it's very easy to pick up and just be like, oh, wow, I can build these crazy spaces and things with relatively little effort and learning time.
Yeah. So do you have any... are there any projects of yours that are in some form of completion? Is there anything that you're particularly proud of to share? I'm just curious.
Well, that's been my big problem so far, is that I've been terrible at finishing projects. Like, I have, oh my goodness, I have a huge projects drive, just like packed to the brim with various concepts and things that I never got around to finishing or putting out, despite, you know, a couple of times being like, oh yeah, you've got those game jams that are like, take something old that you'd never finished and finished it, and just, yeah, never getting around to it properly. So Cadeau is the big, like, the first one that I've put out there and actually tried to get into people's hands and be like, hey, you might be interested in this. What's up?
It sounds like you need a Romero to your Carmack, right? I mean, it's almost like you got to kind of combine your talents with another, maybe more person that's got more experience generating assets and things like that, and kind of, you know, spit polish, things like that. You know, you might want to...
You could
start
be more right than you know there, I think. Like, Carmack has always been, you know, like, what's the term? You know, like, oh, he's my code hero, my programmer hero. Holy moly, he's done so much crazy stuff and given, you know, games and 3D so much. And I suppose, to a certain degree, without trying to, you know, toot my horn or anything like that, fall into that sort of, like, I'm the guy who's, like, all in on the code and building systems and tools and things like that. And, yeah, it would be amazing to, you know, try and find the Romero to my Carmack, as you say.
Well, I think someday your prince will come, man. Anyway, so now you've been in the Quake scene for about 3 years, roughly. And are there any other games that kind of have captured your imagination or that you're a huge fan of that you maybe aren't making content for, but that you know, that you're excited about?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, when I found time to give myself a break from doing Cadeau in this sort of like 22-day whirlwind that it's been since I started, Mech Warrior 5 has been the sort of like big thing I've been dumping my time into and trying to sort of figure out, because it's a sim. It's big on the or at least it's the Mech Warrior community is big on the whole like HOTAS pedals, you know, like you buy crazy peripherals in order to play these games and feel like you're actually piloting a big giant robot. And so aside from taking about 8 hours to configure the thing and make it work properly on my setup, which is, it happens with these games.
Yikes.
It's been like mental. Like, it's the most impressive giant stompy robot simulator that I've ever played. So I've really been enjoying that, just sort of like immersing myself in the idea of being a mercenary in the grim dark future and all of that stuff.
Now, and you've created VR content, correct?
I have, yeah. I worked for about a year in sort of doing enterprise VR experiences for various different things, be it, say, showing off a like new medical product targeted at like brain surgeons or that sort of thing, like showing it off in extreme sort of like 3D model detail and such like. Like, I've diddled a little with VR gameplay stuff as well. Worked on a sort of like a basic tower defense thing, nothing too impressive, but it was a sort of like first VR project for the animation studio that I was working at the time, who were sort of branching out into this real-time stuff. And so, yeah, I have a bit of experience in VR, and it's, I think it's, yeah, it's a really interesting medium. Lends itself very well to cockpit-style stuff at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, this is much different, and it's not the ideal experience, but I played a little bit of No Man's Sky in VR, on PlayStation VR, and I wouldn't...
How did you find it?
I was disappointed overall in the experience, but being in the cockpit, and I just remember looking at my hands so often going, wow, this is so cool, man. I mean, I'm pretty experienced with VR. I have a few systems and I've never made content for it, but I would like to one day, we'll see. But yeah, just being having those Move controllers and being able to have that one-to-one with your at least your wrist, you know, and kind of hitting the buttons, it just adds so much to that particular title. It's one of those things like, God, this is like always meant to be this way. Now that aside, the performance and the rendering is all a compromise, and it's unfortunately the visual fidelity drops when you're in VR in that game. But when you're not in VR, it's, you know, stellar. It's a beautiful game. But and I could see if people using the PC version on Vive or what have you have a really great experience. I just don't have that set up.
Yeah, I fiddled around a bit with the PC version of No Man's Sky, actually. A friend of mine bought it for me just, like, out of nowhere. It's like, oh, wow, thank you. Mm-hmm. So I fiddled with the, like, you know, the 2D traditional non-VR version and sort of tuned it up and what have you, and was pretty impressed with, like, I'm still fairly lost in it from the little I've played. You know, there's a lot to take in terms of maintaining your resources, building your bases,
finding your
planets, all of that stuff. But when I jumped into the VR, it just felt overwhelming. Like the dealing with all of the menus and things and that, and like trying to just like figure out how to do basic tasks, like managing your inventory and whatnot. And I think that that's a thing with VR, is that because it takes such a toll on you, like a physical toll of tricking your brain into, you know, thinking you're somewhere else and dealing with stuff like the motion sickness from free movement and vection from rotation and all of these things. Like there is something to be said for making the like user interface experience as simple as is possible, which is really tricky for something like No Man's Sky, because it has that existing like huge structure of like inventory spaces and ship slots and menus and concepts that you have to be cognizant of while you're stood there in your room scale VR setup, like developing a slightly cold sweat because you're just trying to think of so much stuff.
Oh, I totally agree. I didn't even bring that to my critique. But that's part of the game mechanics anyway. So your resource management and, like you say, all the slots and things, it is completely overwhelming. Especially because I played No Man's Sky when it first came out and was way more limited. So now there's just so many additions with base building and all the new craft. Like when I started, it was only the, you know, your spacecraft basically, and you know, your suit. Yeah, it's grown exponentially. My preference, like, let's put it this way. If I made a game in VR, I would not have a HUD. It would all be about the experience that you're having. And I'm sure there are games like that would be much better in VR and probably already are out. But that's the approach I would take.
I think there's a lot of value to that. Like I think that the big strength of VR right now is that fine-grained interaction between your hands and, you know, stuff in the environment or on your person. Not necessarily about, like, I'm going to stick a, you know, like a fancy sort of tablet HUD style thing that pops up as a hologram when I raise my wrists, and then it has tons of infinite options inside it. Like the tactile, I'm going to physically take this thing off my belt and interact with some mechanism on it to make a thing happen, is so much more interesting and sort of suited to VR as a medium. Mm-hmm. Than having to deal with like the brain mangling that is like, oh my God, so many screens and user interfaces. Like even Elite Dangerous, which I consider to be an excellent VR title, has issues with that just because they have to fit so much stuff in terms of similar things to No Man's Sky, resource management, like handling contracts that you're taking as, you know, a freelancer and all of these things. And it's just a lot to deal with. So I think there's a hell of a lot of value in making things simple and tactile in VR scenario.
Have you played Red Matter?
Red Matter? No, that doesn't ring a
make
bell.
Make it a priority with whatever system you have. Make it a priority, because what you just said about the interface and tactile, they just nailed it. It's a much simpler game. It's more of a puzzle game. And I have it on Quest. And so with the touch controllers, they've divided up, you know, you have three items on your left hand and three items on your right hand. And it takes a few minutes to kind of like, oh, how do I do this? But it's very intuitive, and it's a great look. It's a beautiful game. But that's kind of more what I'm talking about. You know, like, you're looking in the world. There's no real menu that comes up. It's an iconic menu that's on the device that your hands are representing your hands in the game. It's really cool. Really entertaining game too, actually.
I'll have to take a look at that. And I think that the wave of sort of like tactile, diegetic in-world user interface, you know, user interfaces that are actually part of the game world, like Doom 3's computer screens, where you're actually looking at a screen and the mm-hmm. mouse is moving on a thing inside mm-hmm. the world. That's been like a little while coming for games in general, starting with Doom 3 and then also Dead Space. The way Dead Space did the whole thing of like, okay, you do have a little hologram UI for your user interface, but it's projected from your suit helmet in front of your guy. It's in the world. And like your health bar is on your backpack on your suit, because that's like the actual readout in the game world that says this thing needs to be fixed up, otherwise it's going to stop protecting you, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think VR as a step from that is like it's almost like it was, you know, meant to happen, and a thing that people had been thinking of, and sort of like a thought that had been circling in the noosphere of, you know, like game development thought for a little while ahead of VR becoming mm-hmm. a thing.
You know, I'll say that I don't have a lot to comment on VR. It kind of creeps me out, but I feel like this is touching on what we discussed earlier, which is streamlining the user experience. So whether that's in the tools or the games itself, it's kind of in the same vein.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the idea of ergonomics and man-machine interface, trying to make tasks that would, like sequences of actions that you would otherwise be doing, you know, repetitiously, and slimming that down into something that's simple and intuitive. And like that's something that can apply in all sorts of different fields, you know, as well as you like video game UI, VR, sort of just anything that involves having to deal with a mechanically codified sequence of logic or actions.
Right.
Well, let's talk about some of your kind of non-gaming ventures. You have a music tracker that you created, which is very cool. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm familiar with other trackers. I don't know if you know Sunvox.
You may have the wrong idea. I've not made my own tracker or anything. I'm just very much into Amiga tracker music as a sort of like musical genre.
Okay, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought you had made your own.
Sorry, no. Just like it's something that it's another element of something that got into my head from an early age. From the same friend who got me into Quake, actually. He had an Acorn Archimedes 2, which was an old sort of like British computer that roughly matches the Amiga sort of like, you know, specs and whatnot, what it can do. And so it got a lot of Amiga ports. And I spent many an hour on, you know, like a Saturday afternoon, hearing, you know, like quality Amiga tracker music as we played, like, I don't know, Mad Professor Mariotti or Lemmings and what have you, all sorts of like old classics. And it's just sort of like become lodged in my brain ever since. It's like, yeah, this is the music genre for me.
Right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, like that. The interesting thing about the Amiga is that games aside, it actually had a very active music scene, simply because like the tracker software and sound hardware was so good. Like you've got artists like say Skaven or Jogaya Liljedahl, who were like pretty big names in the scene, making all sorts of like incredible sounding like electronic tunes just using these old ass, you know, like 16-bit computers and such. It's yeah. Really something. And because it's all, because of, you know, the whole tracker sampler kind of deal, it's got a very unique sort of like audio aesthetic about it that I find very appealing.
What is that icon, your what am I trying to say? Your your profile picture on Discord.
Oh, avatar.
Sorry. Thank you. Old man brain here. What in the hell's your avatar? Is that Dark Crystal-ish?
It is, yes, that's Fizzgig from the Dark Crystal. The what's the term? The platonic perfection of Muppetry himself. Just a fucking, like, a sphere with
exactly.
a face.
Fizzgig. Like a furry sphere with a I face. Need to Perfect. Revisit The Dark Crystal because I haven't seen the new one on Netflix, and I hadn't seen Dark Crystal since I saw it in the theaters before you guys were born.
I only saw it like in my teens around a friend's house, you know, like who was into sort of like unusual stuff. And it was like, oh yeah, cool, let's watch The Dark Crystal, this like weird, you know, dark Muppets thing. Like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, man. It's pretty messed up.
Fizzgig is now, yeah, my favorite, just because, like, I don't know, he's simple, appealing, and fun. And also there's just like the one frame of him where he doesn't look, you know, like he's about to throw a tantrum and start barking at everything. You know, he looks like a bit bored, a bit cynical, and that's the avatar for me.
And it just made, whenever you make a wisecrack, which I've seen you post a few kind of goofy things here and there, it just makes it even more funny. When you see that.
Yeah, exactly. It's the juxtaposition.
Oh, man. So listen, is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about?
Goodness me. I think we've gone across quite a few topics, eh?
I mean, I think we could probably just wrap up with Quido and just see what, maybe how far you want to take it. I wanted to ask you about that, like what the future might bring, because you already got a lot of interest in it so far, and that video is going to just wait, it's going to explode. It's going to be a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm still reeling from that, to be quite honest. It's just like, wow, okay, suddenly 80,000 eyes potentially on my thing. Hi, yeah. Guys.
No, hey, do me a favor and set that up, because Games From Scratch, I'm familiar with the channel, but I watched a lot of it yesterday. But so could you just set that up, you know, that the video came out on his channel? I'll take a look and see how many hits it got. Let's see.
Oh yeah, I've not like dug deep into the analytics or anything. Like, I don't even know if I can mine it for any of that. But just like seeing, you know, like reading through the comments and just being like, wow, it's 80% people being like, I can't pronounce this. Why did I choose this name? But that's how things go when you're making a derivative thing that you just add a Q on the start of.
Yeah, and that was the first thing that Dump Truck and I talked about when we started this session before you got brought in. It was like, wait, so how do you pronounce this thing?
Well, that's part of the fun, is that like the Godot community as it is has enough trouble like agreeing on how you pronounce Godot. I just use the, you know, like waiting for Godot pronunciation as per like the classical work or whatever. But so I say it Kudo, because it's just like, okay, cool, just swap the Q, like the G for a K, because Q's are funky and K is close enough. But then like you've got all sorts of other pronunciations like Q dot and
Quo dot.
Quo dot and
Quo dot.
That was my initial assumption.
Well, I was a theater geek in high school, so I knew Godot for sure, for Waiting for Godot. But but one thing, just interject there, you've got 9,600 views in one day from Games From Scratch. So I'm sure, I don't know if your Discord went off yesterday.
It did a little bit, yeah. We had like a little, just a set of users piling in all of a sudden, like, oh wow, hey guys, new faces, all sorts of like stars being added to the repo on GitHub and forks being created, which is very exciting, because so far about like only one or two people have been like, yeah, I'm going to fork this and make my changes to it and maybe bring that back to master and be like, hey, do you want these cool upgrades I've made? So it's going to be very interesting to see what people, you know, like make on top of my work and then hopefully bring back into the master branch. That would
cool.
be rad.
That is great. Well, and so I think that kind of covers the future of Quido. But I just want to make sure you spoke about everything you wanted to hit on there.
Yeah, so you mentioned like future plans. And, well, I suppose every piece of software will eventually become feature complete. At least that's the ideal. And I've gotten it up to 1.5.0, which is a big feature release. It's, you know, got lots of stuff to sort of aid the configurability of the map geometry to make it better for an individual use case. Like if you wanted to use it with a software culling plugin that has to work with the Godot tree or something to that effect. Or whether you want to, you know, like crunch everything into one mesh for optimal draw call stuff. But I've still got a good, like healthy swath of tasks like on the GitHub tracker, which people can like see. That are marked for 1.6.0. So my next plans include things like being able to more fine-grainedly determine what class names in the map file get processed by which stages of the build, that sort of thing, making it easier for people to define their own sort of like Quake style class structure. And then we've got future tasks as well, but the like big sort of like long form stuff, like potentially covering other engines or different formats of map like VMF and things like that, you know, big tasks that are like large, scary, but I don't want to take off the table because they're interesting ideas, but at the same time I don't want to actively commit to and be like, yes, we're bringing this in the next version, because it's like, that's a really big hole to dive down. Those are some big things to commit to. So it'll be interesting to see where things go, like whether I can get, you know, more contributors on board to like help out with things like that, and perhaps take it like in the direction that Trench Room has gone, whereby, like, you know, it's got a consistent pace of development, although right now it's largely focused on the cute refactor, but has, you know, plenty of people contributing. Well, actually, no, it is largely Eric W. and Christian, isn't it? But yeah, I suppose just raising the profile of the project and getting more eyes on, and perhaps getting a few people helping out, because I'm just one guy at the moment.
Yeah, understandable. Well, congratulations on your success, and just 20 days in, it's already got a great response. It seems like it performs fairly well. I haven't played with it yet, but you know, later down the line, I think I will be.
And who's to say that when this airs, maybe some Quake community guys would be interested in helping out.
Absolutely, I'm hoping so, because like some of the most helpful people so far have been from the Quake community, in terms of like working with Quake in the past, its map formats, like just explaining to me the ins and outs and nitty-gritty of QBSP and how it handles certain like core things, like, oh yeah, funk detail gets moved into the world spawn during build and your tool should do that as well, for, you know, technical reasons, things like that. And it's been so unbelievably helpful to have folks that know what they're on about, because I know Quake on a, you know, like a player level. I've played Quake, I know its rules, but I don't necessarily know that fine-grained like in and out that the mapping community knows inside out, upside down.
Yeah, and there's a multitude of people that just have so much knowledge, and it's, I mean, there's only so many games where this kind of thing is the case. So the Quake community is one of those special places on the internet, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I've like loved it so far, even though I've, you know, only been hanging around like the Quake mapping Discord and whatnot proper for like the time I've been doing Kado. But yeah, it's been great meeting new people and like learning new stuff. It's absolutely fantastic, and I could not recommend it more to anyone who's interested in getting into like Quake mapping, anything along those lines.
That's it for this episode 44 of the Quakecast. Thanks for listening. We will be back soon.
Hey, Happy New Year. I am still recovering from the New Year hangover.
Do you need some ice? Like, you need an ice bucket to put your... What the hell am I trying to say?
There's
a blooper.
I wasn't prepared.